Well, you can say hi if you want to.
Hi, this is
Howdy.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Greg LeMond. Welcome to the VeloCast.
That's nice, really nice, yeah.
Hello everyone and welcome to the VeloCast. With deciduous leaves piling up and daylight noticeably shrinking, most of us here in the Northern Hemisphere have now finally accepted that the central heating needs to be switched on. As such, and with no new road cycling on the TV to stave off the brooding mood, we cast our minds back to when the 2019 season was but a young thing, brimming with bright-eyed newness and bushy-tailed promise. So, pour yourself a contemplative cup of hot chocolate, top it off with a thoughtful squishy cream and a generous amount of meditative marshmallows, and let us regale you with tales of the 2019 Spring Classics, starting, as is only right and proper, with Omloop Hep Noiseblad.
You know, just as a quick overview before we get into each of the races, you know how the human brain does that thing where whatever is most recent is foremost and most popular in your mind? I've been thinking about this season largely as one of breakthrough rides by young riders in the Grand Tours. But going back for this retrospective in the Spring Classics and looking at my notes, we had some fantastic performances from old war horses, and I'd actually forgotten just how bloody good the races themselves were. I think we've had, you know, the blessing of a fantastic 2019, both in the Grand Tours and particularly in the Spring Classics. Going through these races again in my head, I've had a great time just thinking about them.
Well, thank goodness you managed to limit that to the Spring Classics, because when you said what was foremost in your mind, I was expecting, I don't know, this podcast to be suddenly derailed and discussing who Lorraine Kelly was interviewing on Good Morning or something. Well, you've got cancer, that's a pure wee shame.
Actually, Good Morning Britain's okay if once they've got rid of Piers Morgan, he's not been on recently, but we should probably move on to the racing.
Yes, Omloop Hep Noiseblad, won by Zdeněk Stybar, a rider who, I mean, Deconinck Quickstep, as we all know, are the one for all and all for one type of team. They don't care who wins, but you kind of feel that Zdeněk Stybar is the rider who hasn't quite won enough to deliver on the promise that he has or has been expected of him for quite a few years now.
Yeah, I mean, he's had some big wins, but you'd expect him to have a Tour of Flanders and certainly a Paris-Roubaix in his palmarès by now. This was a good sign that Deconinck Quickstep were back to firing in all cylinders after their stellar 2018 season. It was a fantastic win by Zdeněk Stybar. You know, he was a rider on a mission on that day, but for me in my notes, the important thing I've got is a theme that developed throughout the entire spring, and that was Greg Van Avermaet's head was mince.
You know, he's tactical. Yeah,
I mean, he was a disaster. One, his CCC team left him entirely alone. You know, there was very seldom anybody able to give him the kind of help that he deserves as the great champion that he is. But too often, you know, he made the rookie error of doing too much work. It was like watching the rider that we knew and criticised before his fantastic winning streak. And Greg Van Avermaet, for me, lost this as much as Zdeněk Stybar won it.
Yeah, I mean, it came down, if you remember, to a group of five: Stybar, Greg Van Avermaet, Tim Wellens, Alexei Lutsenko and Dylan Teuns. And as you say, John, CCC had worked far, far too much right across the race. And when it came down to that quintet towards the end of the event, it was Greg Van Avermaet who was continually on the front. He just seemed too eager to do all the work, hoping, I presume, to break everybody else in the group. And Stybar just, you know, played right off of that, and his attack with 2.3 kilometres to go was just perfectly timed. Yeah, because he knew that Van Avermaet, having done so much work, would try half-heartedly of whatever was left in the tank to pull him back. But then when that didn't work, he would look to everybody else in the group, who would then look at Greg Van Avermaet and go, well, I'm not towing you to second place. Yeah. So it was perfect from Stybar, but as much a fault of Greg Van Avermaet and CCC, as you rightly say.
And, I mean, there's two other observations I've got from this race. The first is, the Moor and the Bosberg is just definitely the best finish for the Tour of Flanders. You know, Flanders Classics need to get a grip and put that back in and forget about all the extra money they get for the hospitality tents and that massive, you know, finishing straight. And the other one was not just Greg Van Avermaet. What the hell happened to Michael Valgren? You know, he'd been so dominant the previous year. A brilliant season riding for Astana. Moves to another team. Barely noticeable. You know, was it the Molenberg he disappeared on? I mean, he just wasn't part of the race.
Well, in answer to your rhetorical question, but I think it bears saying anyway, Dimension Data is what happened to Michael Valgren. If ever there was, you know, in microcosm, what is wrong with Dimension Data? It's Michael Valgren, as you say, so dominant, so strong for Astana, not only last season, but in the last few years. A rider on the up and up goes to Dimension Data and he just disappears. And it's been the same story all the way through with Dimension Data this year.
Yeah, where careers go to die. There's been the odd flash from Eddie Bosenhagen. There was one bit at the end of the season where I think for the first time all year I saw a three-dimension data jerseys in the same shot at the front of the race at the same time. I mean, they're just a team that really need to reassess with the changes in, you know, the structure of the teams and how access to races and granted and all that kind of thing. If they carry on as they have been, there won't be a Dimension Data next year.
Scary, scary thoughts. Now, moving on then to the next of our Spring Classics races, Strada Bianca. And the start really of, I mean, it's another DeConinck Quickstep rider, but the start really of a really dominant spring campaign from Julian Alaphilippe.
Yeah, I mean, a fantastic ride from Alaphilippe. And for Jakob Fuglsang, the first of many long days spent, you know, staring at the promotional markings in the back of Julian Alaphilippe's shorts. Because Fuglsang had a stunning spring with one massive success that we'll talk about later. But too often for him, he was beaten by Julian Alaphilippe. But the Frenchman was both the strongest rider on the day, but tactically absolutely brilliant. For me, one of the rides of the year, though, was Wout van Aert in third place, because it was the first glimpse that we had this year of the entertainment that these cyclocross stars would give us. And Wout van Aert was dropped. You know, it would have been so easy for him to think, right, I've done well, you know, I've made my mark in the road scene, these guys will take me seriously in future, and sit up and wait for a group to come back to him and ride into the finish. But the determination he showed to get back on just at the Flamme Rouge, you know, he chased the two leaders up in front, just never lifted his head. And of course he blew on that final brutal climb into the square in Siena. But, the sheer exuberance of watching him race with such determination, just it put a huge smile on my face. But Alaphilippe was not going to be denied in the day. He was simply magnificent.
No, it wasn't. And you do kind of feel sorry somewhat for Jakob Fuglsang throughout this Spring Classics campaign, because invariably he would be the one who would start moves, but just the sheer strength and the cleverness, as we'll talk about in a minute, of Alaphilippe shone through, because it was Fuglsang who, in this race to begin with, made the decisive move with over 20k to go, followed by Van Aert, and then Alaphilippe joined up, sensing that this was going to stick. So it's not that Julian Alaphilippe was towering over everybody and Jakob Fuglsang and Wout van Aert were just, you know, who happened to come in second place. You really got to commend Fuglsang's strength across the Spring Classics campaign. He was just beaten time and time again by the better guy up until actually the very last race that we'll talk about. But what I really noticed, just talking about when Wout van Aert managed to rejoin coming into the final kilometre as they approached that brutal climb up to the square in Siena, was how clever Alaphilippe was. He made sure that he sat to the left-hand side of Wout van Aert, putting him in the middle, and thus Jakob Fuglsang was at the barriers. That, of course, meant that if Fuglsang wanted to attack, he'd have to do so in plain view of Julian Alaphilippe. There was no way Alaphilippe was going to get surprised by a Fuglsang attack. So all he had to do was keep looking to his right and wait for the moment when Fuglsang went, which duly happened. Alaphilippe followed, paced his effort, and then took Fuglsang once they made that right-hand turn after the climb itself. A fantastic tactical move.
Yeah, brilliant. And that climb's become one of the iconic scenes of cycling. I mean, as much as the Strade Bianche itself, that flagstone climb, and the fact that the rider, if he comes round that last corner, even slightly ahead, knows that he's got the race in the bag, so there's got time, you know, for the emotion to develop before he crosses the line. It's one of the great finishes in the Spring Classics. Strade Bianche is a race which I absolutely adore, and we need to get there one day. I mean, we really do.
Mm, definitely. I mean, we'll talk about Flesh for Loan later on, but just when you were talking there, I was struck by how great Strade Bianche is, because Flesh for Loan is all about the Mur de Huy, we know that, but Strade Bianche just isn't all about that climb to the town square.
No.
There's so much goes on before it, and you kind of feel that while the Mur de Huy is a fantastic finale, they really need to find something which is going to make the race more than just the Mur de Huy.
Well, it's not even just the Mur de Huy, it's probably about 6 centimetres where you have to judge your jump just right, isn't it? But I mean, yes, we can talk about that when we come to
it. Moving on then, in chronological order, to Milan San Remo, and it's Julian Alaphilippe yet again. He made the initial move on the Poggio. Petr Sagan closed him down, and that led to the bunch who would contest the finish itself. I think about a dozen riders it was who came to the finish line on the Via Roma.
Yeah, I mean, as a presage of what we were going to see in the Tour of Flanders, we'd seen a wee dig from Alberto Bettiol as well. You know, a sign that he was in cracking form and was thinking about a serious chance of a victory in this race. But again, Alaphilippe, tactically brilliant. Did the work when he had to, sat back and let others do, you know, do the same amount of work or maybe even more. We had absolutely, you know, the heads of state for that old cliche in the front group. Vincenzo Nibali, Alejandro Valverde, Wout van Aert again, Mohoric, who had a big dig, Kwiatkowski, Oliver Nassen, and the name which I've got in my notes for this race is Petr Sagan. Because just as we'd seen Greg Van Avermaet give an indication that his tactical head wasn't with it, I think this was the first indication we had that Sagan's form maybe wasn't everything that he would want it to be. You know, and Sagan's absolutely on song. He can see everything that's happening around him. You can tell that he's hyper aware of what the other riders are doing. And it's like watching, you know, a chess master work out what he's going to do. This Milan San Remo, he was caught wrong-footed when the sprint finally started. You know, he was strong enough and had enough class to be in the finishing group. But his brain just wasn't in gear. And we saw that time and again. You know, he was good enough and had enough class to be near the finish and still in with a chance. But his finishing tactics, either because he was tired or, you know, just on a bad day for two or three vital days during the spring, his finishing tactics let him down. But Alaphilippe, once he hit the front, never looked like he was going to get caught.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right about Sagan. I mean, I think it's easy to say, yeah, that was the first sign. But I mean, possibly at the time, we'd need to listen back to the show that we did on Milan San Remo. It might have just been a case of, oh, we'll let him off. Mm-hmm. He's just getting started, you know, because finishing in the top 10 of Milan San Remo is good enough for anybody. Yes, it's a disappointment for Petr Sagan, but we were perhaps looking ahead to the rest of the Spring Classics campaign. But really, you're right, when we look back, the first whisper that something wasn't quite right was in this race. But again, Alaphilippe, tactically brilliant, because they almost came to a halt in the last few hundred metres, and it was Mikael Kwiatkowski who made the definitive attack, but all Alaphilippe did was use his slipstream to come around him, and as you say, there was nobody getting anywhere near him.
And, you know, he definitely the rider of the year for me, you know, single day or Grand Tour. And the kind of spring that you'll never forget, you know, this is a career-changing spring, even when you're already a rider as classy as Julian Alaphilippe. A slightly poignant point that I got looking back on this was when we think about the horrible end he had to the year after that crash in the Giro, which injured his knee. Look, he's in 11th, big time de Milan. You know, 2019 could have been such a great year for him, but for that crash. But, you know, that's professional cycling for you.
I mean, like, I'm not to kind of go on about this any longer than I feel I need to. I'm still not convinced that that crash could, you know, be a career-ending mm-hmm. one. I'm very worried that we won't see the same Tom Dumoulin come back in 2020. Fingers crossed, of course, that he does, but big question mark for me. But let's get back to the spring racing and on to E3 Harelbeke. The Deconinck Quickstep yet again. This time it's Zdeněk Stybar.
Yeah, tried to win solo as he'd done earlier in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Wasn't able to get away. I mean, he had a good dig at, 3 kilometres to go. But a brilliant example of teamwork. You know, this was a race which we thought Bob Jungels might have in the bag. He was away, was very active all through the race. But when finally his attempt at the victory came to naught and he was swept up by the super strong chasing group, he just put himself to work for Zdeněk Stybar. You know, that sign that Deceuninck and Quickstep are happy for any of them to win, and not just lip service. You know, you see it played out in the road that these riders, who are super classy guys in their own right, will immediately put themselves at the service of a teammate if they think he's stronger or has a better chance of winning. And we saw Jungels do that. You know, dropped, fight back, straight to the front. And Stybar played the sprint perfectly. So Greg Van Avermaet, guess what? Good enough to be in the podium, but never looked like he was going to win to me, to be fair. And another flash in fourth place from Alberto Bettiol. You know, that presage of what was to come. But Stybar, 2 wins, his season's made, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you're right to praise Bob Jungels there. It was another tactical masterclass. And again, not to kind of keep harping on about this theme that you set up, how good Deceuninck Quickstep were in their tactics, having two riders in the finishing group, just threw into sharp relief how tactically poor CCC were mm-hmm. in leaving Greg Van Avermaet on his own, up against 2 Deceuninck Quickstep riders. If it had been just one other CCC man put into that group to protect Greg Van Avermaet, it could have fundamentally changed at least the way that Deceuninck Quickstep had to play it. But that doesn't take anything away from Bob Jungels, as you say, dropped after one of Stybar's attacks. When that didn't come to fruition, Jungels, instead of just riding to the finish, having done a ton of work already, made sure he came back to that group, and not only that, straight to the front to put the hammer down for Stybar to make sure everybody was on their limit and not coasting, looking at each other. And that just allowed Stybar to go to the front again and this time make the definitive attack.
Yeah, a brilliant ride. And for CCC, I mean, we used to criticise BMC for having, you know, too many cooks, too many highly paid riders who maybe were a bit entitled, so they didn't put in the teamwork that we expected. You know, we talked about it with Richie Porte in the Grand Tours, and actually we used to talk about it with Greg Van Avermaet as well. But at least I don't have a memory of Greg being so isolated in the previous incarnation of that team. You know, there would be one or two BMC riders up there with him just to, you know, to take the edge, hide him from the wind, you know, let him have a rest before a really big dig. But he was on his own all spring, you know, and it's easy for me to sit here and criticise his tactical nous. But if you're completely isolated, it's a lot harder to do than if you've got, you know, as Stybar had, he could look across and see Bob Jungels and he knows that he's got a partner in crime. You know, somebody there to help him out. Whereas Greg was on his own for the entire spring.
Yeah, I recall saying across the spring that Greg just looked too keen mm-hmm. to take his first win for the new team. And I think if they just settled a bit quicker and done the bread and butter stuff about making sure you've got a teammate alongside you in case, you know, you need a wheel or mm-hmm. because it's good tactics. But yeah, it was that eagerness and just doing too much work that, well, I think Greg Van Avermaet actually had decent form across the spring, that trying too hard meant he made just daft schoolboy errors.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a bad spring for Greg Van Avermaet. I hope he comes back next year. You know, I don't want to see his career be defined by, you know, a bell curve with that flash of genius when he won Paris-Roubaix and all of those other races. But, you know, loads of seconds and thirds on either side of that bell.
Yeah, definitely. On to Gent-Wevelgem. Alexander Kristoff kind of being the surprise amongst what has been a very Deconinck Quickstep dominated Spring Classic campaign. Now, I know that we get used to seeing Deconinck Quickstep dominant across the spring, but I think in Gent-Wevelgem here, Alexander Kristoff finishing it off in that bunch sprint was a wee bit of a surprise given who he was beating round about him.
Well, he's clearly in a rich vein of form. You know, he finished well in the Tour of Flanders shortly afterwards. But I'll be honest, I'd kind of written Kristoff off in my head.
Yeah.
You know, I thought the move to UAE was largely for financial reasons. He didn't seem to have that fire in his belly after Peter Sagan picked him for that world championship on home turf. And I knew he was a classy rider, but I really think when Luca Paolini retired, it was a big blow for Alexander Kristoff, because Paolini seemed to have a magical ability to get the big guy in exactly the position he needed to be in to take the biggest victories. So I was surprised, but I've changed my opinion now. You know, I was watching this race last night, and just the sheer relief and delight as he crossed the line, you know, punching the air in absolute joy, showed that he's still got the fire to win. So I think this might have just been a bad year. You know, we might see a much better Alexander Kristoff in 2020, because he still cares about winning, and that was writ large on his face as he crossed the line.
Speaking of teams who have had a bad year, I mean, it's worth, I think, pointing out, as much as we're criticising CCC, John Degenkolb, who is still on the comeback trail, but his second place was good for John Degenkolb, but maybe was an indication that Trek Segafredo weren't going to have a good year, that, you know, things just weren't going to fall for them. They rounded it off. I mean, I'm saying they, you know, they've got the world champions jersey on the team. It's not a Trek Segafredo world champion, you know, that won, or team that won. Mm-hmm. But Trek Segafredo will reap the benefits of it into 2020, and I think arguably saved the entire season for them. But as I said, that second place from John Degenkolb there was perhaps an indication that while Degenkolb was on the up and up, things just weren't going to go right for the team.
It's going to be interesting. You know, they've got Vincenzo Nibali for next year, who definitely in the twilight of his career, but still a force to be reckoned with. And of course, Mads essentially saved their season. I mean, it was an absolutely terrible season for Trek Segafredo. I don't know if they'll turn that around. I think Nibali's going to help. You know, he's a guy who's taken some key teammates with him, key backroom staff, and he knows how to get results. I mean, even when Bahrain looked essentially very, very ordinary, when Nibali turned up to race, you saw their jerseys. And hopefully he'll bring that to Trek. And the world champion's jersey in your midst is always going to raise a team's spirits, isn't it? So let's hope next year this year for them, because they were mince. I mean, they were genuinely terrible.
Yeah. On then to the Ronde van Vlaanderen. And we've already talked, I guess, in some regard as to how much of a surprise this was, although, or rather on the day, but it had been coming. We had seen Alberto Bettiol place well right across the spring up until this point. But that really doesn't cover just how magnificent he was on the day, and not only that, how magnificent the team were in support of Alberto Bettiol.
Yeah, absolutely stunning. Sepp van Marck had a crash earlier on in the season, wasn't well, but Education First just absolutely nailed it for Bettiol. And Bettiol might be one of these riders who, when, you know, we look back in history, only won one big race. And I've seen a lot of people ask where he came from. But the indications had been there at the start of the season. We've already talked about the races where he'd, you know, raised his head and made an effort already. But even further than that, if you go back in his palmarès, there's loads of top tens in really quite important races. So he's one of these riders who, if everything goes right in the day, if his teammates do the right job for him, if the other riders just look at each other a bit too much and he gets a chance, has always been capable of a big win like this. He might not get another one, but this was well deserved. You know, he absolutely hammered it. He's alone in the Paterberg, less than 20 seconds ahead of the other riders. There's a brilliant shot where he's suffering like a dog on that evil climb, and you can see the others in the back just hovering. But the fact that they weren't able to organise a chase, and you noticed something at the time actually from one of his teammates, which was a spot of tactical genius, so I'll let you expound upon that.
I think that this is possibly one of the best pieces of tactical awareness that I can remember in, if not a one-day race, just across cycling. I think it was Seth Van Mark. It was either, of course, Van Mark or Langefeld. But as you say, with only a handful of seconds on the Paterberg, you look back at that shot, and there's two groups behind them. One is, I think, about four strong, the other maybe five or six strong. And it's in that second group that the EF Education first rider is. And you see him at the head of the group, and your first thought is, what on earth are you doing? You know, you're essentially pulling that second group back towards your man who's out front. Why are you doing that? But it was brilliant from the EF Education First Rider, because in pulling those two groups together, and they had some big names there, you know, the likes of Alejandro Valverde, and I think Petter Sagan was there as well. In doing so, bringing that group, or that group of, say, five or six, together with another group of four, it made that one group chasing Alberto Bettiol too big to control, and ensured that the type of rider that was in that group was sufficiently of high enough status that everybody else was watching them. And there was two or three of those guys, as I say, in that big group. And it meant that it gave enough room for Alberto Bettiol to focus on just staying out front, and the group behind, there was enough guys in it for them to worry about, as opposed to just focusing solely on Bettiol. Absolute tactical genius from EF Education First. And I really can't rate it high enough. We often talk about, you know, for example, Bettiol going with 18 kilometres to go and fantastic exploits from individual riders to win races across the finish line first. But that, in terms of tactical awareness, is to me as brilliant as Bettiol's attack or some of the other great exploits that we talk about. I really, honestly, I can't praise it highly enough.
Yeah, and Bettiol looked like he was having a hard time towards the finish, and finished with just 14 seconds on young Kasper Asgreen, who's not a breakthrough year for him. I mean, an absolutely great year for him, but a young rider amongst the many young riders we've got to watch in the coming years. And Christoph finishing off with what was left of the chasing group, really, at 17 seconds, ahead of someone whose name will feature very largely in a shortly to be discussed race, Mathieu van der Poel, showing that the cyclocross boys aren't just there to make up the numbers.
And of course, if you're talking there about Mathieu van der Poel, but that was the day he almost saved a crash before the front wheel finally gave up and he went right over the handlebars, having hit a piece of street furniture. And you think, oh, right, poor kid, you know, welcome to the big league, and you'll coast home probably in 100th place or so, but, you know, well done for trying. What a comeback.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my first thought was, oh God, his collarbone's brilliant. I've gone. And at this point, people were already talking about him for Amstel Gold. And I thought, that's his spring season over. You know, that when the wheel goes and you just hit the deck with no warning, you know, and it was horrible to watch. But just got back on, put his head down and got back to the sharp end of the race. Brilliant.
Now on to what regular listeners will know is John's favourite race of the season. Paris-Roubaix, was it your favourite race of the season this time?
No, which is an extreme change from the norm. Everybody knows that I love this race. I don't think there's anything that lets us get in touch with the start, you know, the proper history of the sport, when you watch them rattle across the pavé on those so familiar sectors on the road to Roubaix. All you need to do is give it a black and white wash, and you could be back in, you know, 1909 or whatever. It's just astonishing. And even more so, I'd say to people, I keep saying to people about loads of races, actually, you should go and watch it, because it's not the same as watching it on the telly. I don't think there's anything that statement is as true as Paris-Roubaix. You know, until you've seen a breakaway hit the cobbles at the Arnberg Trench at 60 kilometres an hour, you know, with bottles flying out of cages and just the sheer noise and the visceral exhilaration of watching that is an experience that every cycling fan, I think, should get. This race for me, though, it was a fantastic addition. I mean, we had all of the thrills that we usually get. We had, again, Peter Sagan classy enough to be there near the finish, but just not able to follow when the really big move happened. Strong rides from Seth Van Mark again. After that crash earlier in the season, he looked like he might have actually lost some of his best chances for some really big wins a bit later in his career. Yves Lampaert, strong rider all year. All of these guys were there. But this race was about two folk for me. And the two folk were the guys who finished first and second, but it was about them for very different reasons. For Philippe Gilbert, this is the race that I thought, in his quest to win all five of the monuments, was going to be the hardest one for him. But all day he was imperious. He floated across the cobbles like Sean Kelly. He drove when he needed to drive. He was just tactically... He did an Alaphilippe, if you like. You know, he was a perfect rider on the day. But Niels Pollitt, who'd been a strong rider all spring, you know, if we look at the top tens of the races that we've already talked about, Pollitt appears in that a few times. So he's had a good spring already, goes out in the early break, which goes even before the first sector of cobbles, really early in the race, and then is still strong enough not just to hang on to Philippe Gilbert and losing the sprint, but actually to be integral in the race being blown apart when it finally shredded near the finish. So Gilbert, he's on four monuments now. He's a rider who is capable of a Milan San Remo, which is the one he needs. So, you know, he might join one of the absolute greats of cycling and winning all five of the things. But Niels Pollitt, what a ride to be in the early break and then not just hang on, but actually make the race as they approach the roads into the Velodrome in Roubaix.
It's one of those races where if you're strong enough, and that's a big if, there is some tactical sense in going off on an early break. If you're on a good day, it is very much of...
Yeah, I think Matt Heyman would come and,
yeah, come and catch me. Yeah. You know that you're probably going to get caught, Matthew Heyman notwithstanding, but at least if, and again, it's that huge if you're on a good enough day, you'll still have the strength towards the end when you know everybody else is shattered too, that they've caught up with you, and now it's just a case of trying to stay with them when the inevitable attacks come. But with Niels Pollitt up ahead, what I'd take from this race is that Gilbert made this addition his own. He basically spent the entire day grinding everybody else off his wheel in his quest to bring that group containing Niels Pollitt back so that he could then attack it. And the strange thing for me was it wasn't Gilbert then who made the attack, it was Niels Pollitt himself on one of the final sectors of Pave, who put in a blistering attack. I mean, I remember seeing that helicopter shot off to the side rather than from up above, and Pollitt just going at a phenomenal rate to attack. But then, of course, Gilbert with an equally strong counter move to catch him up. And it was clear from that point on it was going to be the two of them coming into the Velodrome. And as much as I wanted Niels Pollitt to take it just for that, you know, the plucky underdog having been in the break all day, I think it was pretty clear to everybody Philippe Gilbert was just not going to be denied.
Yeah, I mean, Gilbert had actually gone solo in Sector 12. You know, he was out on his own at one point. And in many races, you would look at that and think, the man's an idiot. You know, but in Roubaix, that sometimes works. And dear God, we'd seen him do it at Flanders. So this was a trademark performance from Gilbert. You know, when he's on top of the game, he's a rider who is tactically aware and brutally strong. And that's the Philippe Gilbert. But Niels Pollitt gets honorary man of the day for me. But as you say, in any race, if you are going to go out early, Paris-Roubaix is the one because it often does work out. Only occasionally for the victory, but you can often place really high if you're up in that early break.
Now, to what I expect, bizarrely, given the race itself, but not this particular edition, will be your favourite of the year, Amstel Gold.
Well, you know, I lamented that they took the Cowburg. Well, I lamented that they took the finish a kilometre away from the Cowburg. I was wrong about that. I then lamented that they took the Cowburg out of the finish entirely because I thought it would destroy the character of the race. Because, as you know, I've been on the Cowburg a few times, drinking beer, eating frites and watching the race, and it's one of the great places to watch a race. So, you know, I thought they've taken the Cowburg out. It's still in the race, but it's not part of that iconic finale anymore. Guess what? I was wrong again. Because what we had here was what I think is the best finish to a single day race I have ever seen. And I've been watching this sport since 1974, so that's a lot of races. But I've never seen anything like we saw when Mathieu van der Poel, with Raymond Poulidor watching, in the national champions jersey, and with the other riders unable to do a single thing about it, collapse after the line, lie on his back in sheer exhaustion and exultation with the knowledge that he'd won the Amstel Gold, not just well, but in a truly extraordinary way, that if I'm 95 sitting in a bath chair, not able to remember my own name, I'm pretty sure I'll remember the last kilometres of the 2019 Amstel Gold.
It was phenomenal. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I don't think it's, you know, overly exuberant to say it's one of the best things you'll ever see in cycling. Yeah. I mean, you can go back and watch that and still be shocked and surprised at the outcome, because even though you know what happens, the manner in which that comeback, that chase occurred, just beggars belief. You, there's no way. You know, well done that plucky young man. It's not been your spring, but you know, again, like Wout van Aert, welcome to the big league. Your time will definitely come. You'll finish a credible, I don't know, 12th or whatever. But, you know, well done for doing your family and your jersey. Oh my God, look what's just happened. Yeah. It was just jaw-dropping. And I challenge anyone to not have been up and applauding that while watching it on the day. In fact, again, you could probably watch it and still do exactly the same, because it was just what makes cycling a fantastic sport. And yeah, you're right. And when we're old and gray, or older and grayer, we'll be looking back at this and thinking that was just a phenomenal race.
And the thing is, he'd been very active earlier on. You know, he'd forced the pace a few times in trying to break up the race. But finally, we were left with, guess who? Julian Alaphilippe and Jakob Fuglsang. And at this point, you're thinking, Fuglsang must be thinking, oh God, not again. You know, and Julian Alaphilippe's thinking, oh well, you know, that's another big race in the bag for me. And then they're joined by Mikael Kwiatkowski, who's been a bit disappointing in recent seasons, but is still a rider that you can never, ever discount. Now, that trio up front, nobody on earth is going to think that they're going to get caught. You know, they're playing about a wee bit, but not hugely. It's not like they're track standing. And then suddenly, round a corner in the background, and the time gaps had been coming down, but not really that quickly. As you say, at this point, I'm thinking, with all that pressure on his shoulders, this is a great result for van der Poel. But then he gets back on. And he doesn't just get back on, he attacks. And the only person, and all credit to him, who had any idea what the hell was going on was Simon Clark. And he tried to take on the Dutchman, but yeah, there was nothing he could do. He wasn't going to be denied. It was one of the best, it might be the best finish to a race I've ever seen. I was genuinely out of my seat, nervously shuffling backwards and forwards in front of the television. You know, I turned into somebody's granddad watching the horse racing or something. It was just astonishing. And by far my favourite race of the year. Not just for the finish, actually. It was active for a lot of the day, because there were quite a few guys who thought they were in with a big chance of the victory. The Julian Alaphilippe and Jakob Fuglsang show was a delight to watch as ever, but absolutely nothing like watching Mathieu van der Poel cross the line. Raymond Poulidor's in tears on the, you know, on the podium, for God's sake. It was
and quite right too.
It was a beautiful day.
Yeah, it was. And if the team car weren't blaring Ride of the Valkyries into his earpiece throughout that, I'd be bitterly disappointed. On then to the Mour de Huy, on then to the Flesh Alone, as ever, all about the Mour de Huy, but not about Alejandro Valverde for once. But it was the Julian Alaphilippe, Jakob Fuglsang show, a theme that has been so prominent throughout this spring campaign. Fuglsang makes the first significant move on that brutal, brutal climb to the finish. But again, Alaphilippe, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and by now we know the hill pretty much as well as Alejandro Valverde knows it. Valverde had swallowed a fly or a bee or something, apparently. So finished in 11th, which is actually pretty credible if he's got an insect halfway down his windpipe. We watch Jakob Fuglsang, and you're thinking, Jakob, you've gone too early, mate. And guess what? He'd gone too early. Julian Alaphilippe timed it to perfection. And, you know, he's going to win this race umpteen times now. You know, he's still young enough that he's got a longish career in front of him. And people like Valverde have shown that if you learn which of those centimetres to jump on in the Mur de Huy, you can repeat those wins again and again. Because it's a race where whatever they do, it always just comes down to essentially a hill climb. And it's a hill, I mean, you've been to Huy. It's a hill where the opportunities to attack and hold the strength that you need to hold off another rider who's a bit cleverer than you coming from behind, you have to get it just right. And Jakob Fuglsang didn't, and Julian Alaphilippe did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, talking about going to Huy, while watching the race on TV might be a bit dull because you know it's always going to come down to, you know, that paving stone, that particular paving stone at that particular point in the climb. Being there, it's like Ruby in a sense. Mm. It's not quite as visceral, obviously, as Ruby, but it's a fantastic day out, with both the women's race and the men's race coming past you three or four times. It's, you know, a cracking way to spend the best part of a day. If the weather's great, you know, you get a nice bit of a tan and it's a good family atmosphere. The beers are flowing from various stands up at the top of the climb. So, I mean, as much as you're right to say go to Paris-Roubaix because it's such a great experience, go to Flèche Wallonne because it's a cracking day out. Yeah. Just seeing, because the riders themselves, they're not moving any more than about 5 miles an hour going up that climb. So you get to see just how much they're suffering. It's a great, great addition, a great event to go to.
You wouldn't want to be a postie on that hill, though, would you?
No. I wouldn't even want to live on that hill. Obviously, we see there are houses there, but I mean, God, you think of living there. We've been full of the quite literally full of the joys of spring throughout this show, but it is worth highlighting who was in fourth place in this edition of Flèche Wallonne. Bjørg Lambrecht from Lotto Soudal. A fourth place in Flèche Wallonne is the mark of a great upcoming talent. You don't finish fourth in this race unless you're a fantastic cyclist or about to become a great, you know, cyclist. And it's just heartbreaking to see his name there in fourth place, knowing what was going to happen when we came to the Tour of Poland.
Yeah, I mean, a real talent. Apparently universally liked young man, and we're not going to see what would have become, I think, a really notable career. As you say, to be strong enough to be up there at the sharp end in Flèche Wallonne with some of the riders who were behind him is an indication of the class that Lambrecht had. We can only be grateful it doesn't happen more often in cycling. You know, the speeds these guys are going, clad in ever thinner lycra, you know, and with road furniture and all sorts of things to deal with. We get serious injuries, but thankfully fatalities are still relatively rare in the sport. But every one of them breaks my heart. You know, these guys are, these guys are younger than my kids, with their whole lives ahead of them. So, yeah, a bittersweet moment when we saw that name in fourth.
Mm. On now to then the final race of the spring campaign, and it was horrible, horrible weather for the 105th edition of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And finally, Jakob Fuglsang has his moment, although it almost wasn't. It almost was an absolute shocker and one that could have been so, so different in the finale.
Well, before we get onto that, actually, I wanted to highlight one thing about the rivalry between Alaphilippe and Fuglsang, which had gone on all spring. And it was the good-natured manner in which they, you know, they raced against each other. And every time, you know, they were two of the strongest guys in the race. But there's no rancour or dislike between them. And that's really nice to see, you know, that camaraderie. Because when Julian Alaphilippe realised that finally he'd come to the end of his tether, you know, that vein of rich form that he'd been on for all of the spring was finally starting to wane, and he just couldn't hold the wheel. He was beside Jakob Fuglsang, and he apparently turned to Jakob and said, you know, your turn, I hope you win. And that's, you know, that was really nice to hear about. So that was great. But that was then tempered by, you know, I kind of wish I'd had a nappy on watching that finale, because that was one of the most scrotum shrinkingly terrifying moments in cycling that I've seen for a very, very long time. You know, Fuglsang, he's doing what, 50, 60k an hour. Pothole knocks his back wheel out to a point where I thought, you are never going to be able to save that, Jakob. You know, your heart's in your mouth, every nerve in your body suddenly goes, ah, because you think you're about to witness a truly horrible crash. But Jakob held it together and went on to win his first monument. And, you know, that would put paid to all of those memories of watching Julian Alaphilippe's bum dance away from him towards another victory. You know, he's a monument winner now, quite late in his career. And it's a career-making victory, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But he so easily could have gone down so hard that, you know, everything else. Would, you know, David Formolo would have won, who came in second place. Some strong performances from other folk, but the performance of the day was Jakob Fuglsang just saving that rear wheel. I mean, that was just, oh man, it was terrifying to watch.
And it was a two-stage save, really, because there was the back wheel slide that resulted from hitting that pothole or whatever it was. But then he had to quickly manoeuvre so that the bike, and while it was sliding, didn't come in contact with a really hefty-looking pavement. Yeah. I mean, it was a phenomenal piece of bike handling. And you were, when we were talking about this, quite rightly making the point that that jolt of adrenaline that he would no doubt have gotten from saving himself from a really nasty crash may have contributed, in fact, indeed will have contributed to him winning the race, because, you know, he still had a lot to do at that point, and Davide Formolo could have come back to him.
Yeah, I mean, great ride from Formolo, finishing less than half a minute back. But Fuglsang, you know, we've all had it. If you're out for even if you're just out for a run, that thing where you're in the last kilometre before you get home or whatever, the high, the endorphins, and you just, everything gets a wee bit easier. But when you've essentially had somebody doing the equivalent of sticking a needle in your heart full of testosterone, that makes everything a lot easier, because you think, my God, you know, I'm still upright. What the hell's going on here?
I'm alive.
And you know, you don't feel the pain in your legs because you're concentrating on just the sheer terror that you're just going through. But it was a brilliant win. I mean, he was strong all day. There were some great performances. It was good to see Tanil Kanga show. He was first over Lara Doot, which is, you know, a great place to watch this race. And it's again, after a few years of not being that important in the race when it finished up in Ongles, because there were, you know, there were other climbs to come afterwards, again became kind of important in the race, which is good for me. And this finish, which a lot of folk think is a new finish, I'm old enough that this is almost back to the original finish, the one in Ongles, which is, I mean, it's only been there for what, 26 years or something, 27 years, still feels like the new finish to me. But this, I think, gave us a far more open race, far less predictable, and I think was a really good move from the organisers of Liège to take it back to a finish right down in the city centre, beside the river. So Fuglsang had been good all spring. He deserved a win, and to come away with a monument win, I think, was entirely justified. A great season from him, just slightly overshadowed by a better man, and that better man was Julian Alaphilippe.
Which brings me, I think, to a kind of final point about the spring campaign, is that, well, splitting it into various points, I guess, is that there wasn't a Duff race in the entire spring season. I mean, you even go beyond the major races to like Coombe-Brussel-Coorn and the smaller races that happen in between as kind of starters for the bigger ones to come. They were all great races as well. But I think, you know, you talked right at the start of the show about what's most recent in your mind is what you tend to use as fodder for your opinion of the entire season. And I'm thinking specifically here of Julian Alaphilippe and that fantastic stint he had in the Maillot Jaune at the Tour de France. And it somewhat overshadowed what was an immense spring campaign for him. And I think that's a shame that run in the yellow jersey, as phenomenal as it was, for him and everybody watching it, it was one of the highlights of the Tour de France, of course. But as I say, it just kind of feels like Julian Alaphilippe's great spring campaign has been kind of forgotten. And it was really nice, for certainly for me, to go back and look at these races and think, wow, what a campaign he had.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking that as I was looking through my notes, prepping for this show, because towards the end of the year, as in previous years, we'll be looking at, you know, this is about the spring classics, we'll look at the Grand Tours, you know, we'll take a retrospective glance back at what's happened in 2019. And one of the questions that always arises is, who's your rider of the year? And I've been thinking about this for about a month, actually, since the end of Lombardy. And I was slightly undecided until I looked at my notes for the Spring Classics and I thought, don't be daft, John, it's Julian Alaphilippe. I mean, what a season.
You're going to have to be hard pushed to see beyond. I mean, there are a few riders that are springing to mind, but for very, very different reasons. But we'll come to that in another show. However, moving swiftly on, and I'm sure you're utterly sick to the back teeth of us talking about it, but we absolutely promise this is the last time it will be pimped, because our early bird offer for 2020 runs out this coming Sunday.
It does indeed, actually. It was going to run out yesterday, but with Classic Galloway organisation, I forgot to send the reminder that I promised everybody 2 days before it finished until last night. So,
well, in fairness to you, John, at least you didn't promise that you'd be dead in a ditch if it didn't happen.
I'm moving swiftly along there, because that's an entirely different podcast that you and I should really start.
No, I don't. I simply do not have enough medication to see me through a politics podcast. I really don't.
But because I forgot to send out that reminder, we're extending it to Sunday, you know, midnight our time is when the offer will end. Before I give you a final pimp of the early bird offer for 2020, I need to say thank you to, you know, the many of you who've already taken us up on it. Lots of old friends who've been with us for most of the decade of the Velocast, but a delight to see quite a few new names this year. It's good to know that us waffling rubbish about cycling is entertaining enough for people to give us their hard-earned money. And Scott and I really appreciate that. You know, we can't tell you how much it means to us. But meanwhile, if you haven't already given us your hard-earned money, why not? You know, the early bird offer at $59.90 is the least expensive way to get all of our Velocast content next year. We've got new contributors joining us with Chris Sidwells and Peter Cossens, you know, absolutely stellar cycling writers, and they'll be giving us cultural and historical content. We'll be doing our shows of daily analysis about the Grand Tours, which, you know and love, we've been doing those for years now. Same thing for the classics. We'll be adding more shows on the days of races for some of the minor races in the run-up to the classics, because we did that towards the end of this year and quite a lot of you told us that you really enjoyed that, so we'll be making them more of a feature. We've got some other ideas, but all of that's already confirmed. So by going to velocast.cc and clicking on the early bird offer for $59.90, you get all of our content for less than a fiver a month. It means the world to us, and we'll do our absolute utmost to keep you entertained and to give you analysis which helps you enjoy the races and maybe think about them in a slightly different way. Again, those of you who've already taken us up on it, it means so much to Scott and I, so thank you.
Co-signed is all I can say to all of that. All that's left to say on this show, though, is thank you so much for joining us this week as we looked back at the ins and outs of what was a fantastic Spring Classics campaign. Join us again soon for more Cycling Shake It All About in the next edition of the Velocast.